We have 11 bills. We've got this room tonight. There's an outside chance if we move along and get along. Never know. So with that, we heard we're going to go to Senate File 1370, Senator Marty. I think we heard testimony on this bill and some of your witnesses the other day, and I think the idea was to leave and maybe get an amendment or two to...
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Is that correct?
After we presented the amendment, some of the people from some of the amusement ride operators came here and they had a concern about the dates and so on. And that's Mr. Schultz from Department of Labor and Industry met with them and came up with a 6 amendment, which is in the form of delete everything because there are lots of little, adding State Agricultural Society for the State Fair Board in some places, and Senate Counsel could probably tell what else is in there. But the A6 amendment is what I have an A8 amendment to that I'll describe briefly, but just as a general overview again, Minnesota has had in law for about 15 years a rough outline of what might be called amusement ride safety inspections done by insurance companies for the ride operators. After some incidents last year, the department and I and several other legislators took a look at what we do to try and set up a basic framework on how we do this in a rational way, not panicking because there's not a rash of incidents or anything, but just trying to make sure we have a good regulation system. So the bottom line is that this bill would require inspections of all amusement rides by people who are certified as amusement ride safety inspectors. It has several requirements. In terms of the insurance requirements, we increase that from $1 million to $2 million per occurrence. We have some ride operator training requirements. And then we require daily inspections of the ride by the operator. In other words, it's not you're not calling in somebody, but the ride operator is supposed to look it over each day. And then we have provisions if there's an incident, a serious injury, illness, that it would have to be inspected. We give the commissioner and law enforcement the ability to come in at any reasonable time to inspect if they have a concern. We require reporting of a log of all incidents that occur, and for serious accidents, and they would have to report them. And the commissioner has the ability to step in and get the information they need. They can issue an injunction to shut down a ride if it's unsafe. We give the operators clear statutory permission to enforce their rules related to rides. And we have the A8 amendment to that amendment, which would do 3 things. One, it would take out an age requirement in here because we found out there's another provision on underage workers that already covers that. And number 2, would change it so that after a serious injury or illness, that it's inspected by a certified amusement ride operator and approved by the commissioner. The department thought that was good language to make sure the commissioner can step in more if they need to. And then finally, that if there is a serious injury, that the incident not only would have to be reported to law enforcement or the commissioner, but that they would investigate the accident. That's what the A8 amendment is to A6. I did not bring any witnesses to testify in support or opposition to the bill. There may be some, but John Schultz is here from Labor and Industry.
I think we had a couple of little operators that were in last whatever we heard, and they were concerned about the date or something. Right. Is that fixed up in here, Mr. Schultz?
Senator Marty, committee members, my name is John Schultz. I'm with the Department of Labor and Industry. The local amusement ride operators did express concern regarding the inspection of their amusement rides prior to the first operation in Minnesota. Many of them operate, they start their operations at very small events, community events, and the like, and they believe that the requirement for total inspection prior to first operation would create a hardship for them. We compromised and require that inspection to be done by July 1 of that calendar year, and then only conditioned on that same amusement ride had been inspected the previous year. So we believe that's a reasonable compromise.
Okay, so I don't know if we have to hear from any. We heard all the testimony, at least. that I need
Mr.
to hear.
Mr. Chairman, I know Mr. Sinclair from the State Fair Board is here if there are any questions, and I assume there may be some ride operators as well.
Okay, is there anybody in the audience that feels they should be heard on this legislation, either for or against? Let me announce that we do have a quorum, so. All right, Senator Boniff, would you like to? Well, we've got to put the amendment on first. Okay, we're working. Senator Boniff moves the A6 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and she amends the amendment with the A8 amendment. On the amendment to the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, Senator, any further discussion? Senator Boniff now moves that Senate File 1370 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Marty, you want to stay seated? Senate File 1085, mercury-containing products, provisions, modifications. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a bill that deals with the state of Minnesota has a goal of reducing mercury emissions by 93% over a couple-decade period of time. We're making good progress on that. Last year, the legislature required coal-fired power plants put in stricter emissions controls. Major issue there. This is some of the areas that have not been addressed recently. The legislature did pass a ban on mercury thermometers several years ago. This bill tries to get at a number of the other mercury-containing products. And I have Karen Skoog from Institute for Agriculture Trade to speak to the bill briefly, and we have the bill has been through another committee, but we have an amendment to the bill that was designed to address some of the concerns that came up since the time of that. And again, most of the bill we've been trying to work for a long time with the Electrical Manufacturers Association and others, and I don't want to characterize where people stand, and I'll let them speak for themselves, but I'll have Ms. Skoog speak to the bill and the A6 amendment, which is designed to try and accommodate a lot of the concerns that we've heard from auto industry and others.
Hey, Ms. Skoog, did you want us to adopt the amendment, or you just want to discuss the whole thing now?
Chairman, I'd love to have that adopted, but it can't be an author's amendment because it's already been through a committee, and this was designed to address concerns, but
All right, why don't you just start discussing the bill.
Thank you, Chair Metzen and members of the committee. As stated, my name is Karen Skoog. I work for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, and I'm really happy to be here to be working on this important piece of legislation. Basically, the bill in front of you right now, Section 1, expands recycling requirements for mercury-containing products, such as thermostats, and we already have for the thermometers, measuring devices. There is a small amendment change that was suggested to us by the Solid Waste Administrators Association, and that is to change the language on page 2, line 5, disposed of and insert recycled. There's just a couple of small technical changes, so we have done that with this amendment here. Section 2 expands the labeling requirements for certain mercury-containing products, including fluorescent and high-intensity discharge lamps. And there is also some amendment language changes in the A6 amendment related to the labeling provision. Basically, what we're saying is that any other of the IMERC states, it's the Interstate Mercury Education and Reduction Clearinghouse Program, of which Minnesota is a part of, any other exemptions or labeling provisions that have been approved by an IMERC state are also able to be approved here in the state of Minnesota. So we're just trying to, this is something that we've come to in working with the Electrical Manufacturers Association to try to accommodate so that the manufacturers don't have to label specifically just for Minnesota's purposes. So we feel comfortable with this compromise here. The other piece that we need to do a verbal amendment to in this section that somehow didn't make it into the A6 amendment is that on line 2.18, we need to reinstate the stricken language that says other than a motor vehicle. This is because The auto manufacturers let us know that they've already phased out the switches in new vehicles, but there are old vehicles still in commerce right now that would contain a mercury switch, and we don't want to ban the sale of those used cars. So we will need to offer that we reinstate that stricken language as well.
What's it other than what? Give me the
It's line. On line 2.18, other than a motor vehicle is the language that needs to be reinstated, and apologies for that not making it into the amendment in front of you.
We'll handle that when we do the amendment.
Section 3 deals with, clarifies the requirements that were passed in 2006 for the utility notification of mercury content in fluorescent lamps. It's pretty straightforward. Sections 4 through 11 ban the sale, distribution, and use of a number of mercury-containing devices for which there are proven, cost-effective, and available mercury-free alternatives. It includes measuring devices, the blood pressure cuffs, thermostats, switches, and relays. There is an amendment addition to this section. It's an exemption process that was developed by the Pollution Control Agency with no fiscal note that allows any manufacturer who has received an exclusion or an exemption in another IMERC state may apply for the same exemption here in Minnesota. They just have to submit a copy of that approved exemption to the commissioner and then meet the requirements in that state, and then that's okay for Minnesota. So in this way, we're again allowing the manufacturers the ability to apply for exemptions to these different provisions. Section 12 is just a definition of a mercury-containing product. Section 13 is a reporting provision, and basically what we're asking for is that the lamp reporting or the lamp recycling facilities report to the agency beginning in 2008 on the number and types of lamps that they have been that they've received, and this will help us in the future as we design new programs for the better collection of the lamps. We'll be able to know what kinds of lamps are out there and how they're being used and how that the promotion of selling the lamps is increasing, hopefully, the recycling as well of the lamps. And the agency has indicated that they will put a report on their website that will keep that information consistent. Section 14 deals with mercury prohibition in schools, and we have run this by the Minnesota School Board Association and the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. They are fine with this provision. Basically, it's just a phased-in approach that gets mercury-containing products out of schools where it's appropriate. There's an exclusion for thermostats and the air handling systems that are large pieces of the building. It's just for the smaller products. And then Section 15 also has an amendment change where we are taking out the language that's currently in the bill right now, and as you can see with the amended language, basically what we are trying to require here is that retailers either offer a sign with information about the mercury content in the lamps and that they need to be recycled under Minnesota law and these are the places, or that they offer themselves as a recycling receptacle place for the lamps. And we have scaled down the size of the sign. Basically, what we are looking to require is a 36-point font, which is about this size. We have changed the language so that the retailers have the option of a much larger sign or other additional language that promotes the sale of the lamps. We definitely support the sale of the lamps, but we also think that, as with the statute that requires signage for motor oil and the Minnesota statute that requires signage for batteries, that the fluorescent lamps are another consumer product that has a hazardous substance in it that consumers are not, in general, aware of, and that there is a risk to them directly in exposure and an environmental concern. So we just want to make sure that everyone is doing their part. We have a labeling requirement for manufacturers. We think the retailers should also have a responsibility for notifying consumers or offering themselves, like I said, as a recycling site. And IKEA is a large a large retailer that does offer recycling for fluorescent lamps, as well as quite a few smaller hardware stores that have partnered with Xcel and Minnesota Power to offer themselves as a recycling site. So we know that this is a method that works. The only other piece of the amendment, which I think that I may have excluded to mention, is we've also added an exclusion for some of the existing equipment that contains the switches and relays. If the component is part of a larger product that was in use prior to January of 2008, there is an exemption for that. So a larger, for instance, medical diagnostic equipment that has a small switch in it, we don't want to require a hospital to spend $1 million to replace that piece of equipment just because of a small switch. They are allowed under this exemption to replace it with a mercury switch. And then we're also authorizing the Pollution Control Agency to participate formally in the IMERC process, of which they have been engaged already, but we'd just like to make that an authorization in statute.
I believe Ms. Skoog, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much described the bill and the amendment. And I think if it's all right with the committee, we'll put the amendment on and then get it in the shape that the author would like it and then hear the debate, okay? So, Senator, oh, and then we add on the A6 amendment, we're going to add on other than motor vehicle. Is that it, the four words?
Right. Reinstate that language on page 2.
So, Senator Tomasoni includes that on his motion. The A6 amendment.
And then, Mr. Chairman, one other word on page, on the amendment, page 1, line 16, the second last word, sold, should be replaced with the word manufactured.
Where is he?
That was to request the electrical manufacturer's thing. It in effect would make it effective for products manufactured after that date. So, in other words, they could, even if it's in the stores after that, be allowed as long as it was manufactured before then. So it delays it, which the manufacturers requested.
I don't see that. Is it
on the amendment, page 1 of the amendment, line 16, the effective date section. The amendment to this section applies to products manufactured on or after.
Oh, okay. We will incorporate that. All right. On the Tomasoni amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. I understand. yep. Do you have any further testimony? I know we've.
Mr. Chairman, we have briefly. I think Peter Larson, the former PCA commissioner, is here and may have somebody with him speak briefly about the fluorescent lamp issues and so on.
Okay. Welcome to the committee and. As always, identify yourselves for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Peter Larson. I'm an attorney in Edina, and my client here is Mercury Waste Solutions. I have with me Brad Buescher, who's the CEO of Mercury Waste Solutions, and also Lynn Petros Wynn. Ms. Petros Wynn is also a Minnesota employer and a recycler of mercury and also a recycler of computer parts. Just briefly, we just wanted to talk about compliance with these types of laws in Minnesota. Mercury Waste Solutions recycles about 5.5 million lamps up in Roseville that come from across the country. What I wanted to just show you is the type of thing that most Minnesotans would probably use to comply with this type of law. This is a box that was pioneered by Mercury Waste Solutions. It can be picked up by UPS anywhere in the country. You order this, you get it back into your store, you fill it up, you set it up for your UPS person. It comes to Mercury Waste Solutions. Mercury Waste Solutions recycles. It sends you by email a recycling certificate, and you can keep records of your own lamps in order to show that you've complied with this law. The interesting thing about this, I think, for a committee like this is that this was really designed for small businesses. It was an idea that those that didn't have a lot of lamps would find an easy way to recycle. This has turned into a major part of the mercury recycling business. Target, Best Buy, UPS, Yum Brands, Wells Fargo, Bank of America. This is the way people recycle their lamps. And it doesn't matter if you're sitting in Roseville right next to our store or Baudette. You can order one of these, get it delivered to your business, put it out when it's full. This will cost about $70 for 128 of the types of lamps now that you see a lot, the T8 lamps, about 65 of the T12 lamps. This is really, in the end, the way the businesses we're going to take care of their lamps. It's not necessarily as much a recycling product. It's a way for people to show that they're really maintaining compliance with the law and making sure that they're recycling lamps. Those 5.5 million lamps probably, if they weren't recycled, would release something like 100 pounds of mercury per year into the environment. If you see mercury lamp or mercury bills come through here, you'll note that that's a lot of mercury. This is really the other half of the mercury problem, other than coal-fired power plants. A lot of talk goes on about mercury coal-fired power plants, but the products still are a big part of the problem. And these two Minnesota employers have a solution that businesses are using right now.
My name is Brad Buescher. I'm the CEO of this company Peter was just referring to, and it's always my pleasure to correct Peter whenever I get an opportunity in public. It's about 8.5 to 9 million lamps a year, of which half of those come out of Minnesota. Put that in perspective, there is somewhere estimated by the manufacturers approximately 4 to 5 lamps in service for every human being that lives in a political jurisdiction, which would roughly suggest that we have 20 to 25 million lamps here in Minnesota that are in service today. Less plus what's being sold on an annual basis. A very small percentage of those are really being recovered by either my company or Ms. Petros' company, who's sitting to my right. As a result of this bill, we're very pleased with this particular provision. It requires facilities such as ours to provide accounting and accountability because, as Jack Welch noted in his famous Six Sigma, an acronym when he took over GE, that if you can't measure something, you can't manage it. And the compliance rates are abysmal. And indeed, this will be a first step to try to provide some kind of level of accountability across the platform. Of course, we don't think it goes far enough. Indeed, generators are ultimately the people that are responsible under both federal law and also as a body of practice here in the state of Minnesota. But we're very pleased that this will provide the onus on ourselves and our competitors to do so. And, in fact, we're already doing it. We have a relationship that's unique with both Target and Best Buy, where we provide them with monthly reporting that details not only the facility, but the amount, the quantity. We do it in weights, pounds, and measures. And they use it as a management tool today. It allows them to not only assure that their particular stores are in compliance, but in several different cases, they've actually gone back and audited to see if the manufacturer's respective warranties regarding lamp lives were being met. And in two of those cases, they went back to the manufacturer on end-of-life warranty issues. So the notion behind tracking and some accountability is a time or is an idea whose time has truly arrived, and we applaud this measure greatly. I'm also very pleased to tell you that this morning in Bentonville, Arkansas, the world's largest retailer, Walmart, announced they are going to do a nationwide retail take-back program, and they're going to build it on the back of this particular program. And with favorable consideration of your bill, we appeal upon them to advertise this and make Minnesota somewhat of the centerpiece in that this is Minnesota would become the first state to actually require these kinds of tracking requirements. They like that idea. And they think it's also an idea as time has arrived. And there's been a huge debate going on about how to make this more convenient, how to make this more accessible to the public. Certainly there are provisions in here that require labeling and other those kind of features. And Walmart's decided, in part because of their initiative to sell 100 million new CFLs in the next 12 calendar months, that they ought to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And they're going to take these things back. And they're going to start in Minnesota on June 23rd. And I thought that was a very important ingredient. We pressed them to try to get that decision this morning and so that we could share that with you today. And I just couldn't tell you how much we appreciate the opportunity to be here and that we think that we're on the leading edge and that this is an idea whose certainly time has arrived.
Okay. Again, I want to remind everybody we have 11 bills today, so we've got to try to condense. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Lynn Petros-Wynn. I'm the CEO of Recycle Technologies. I'm also a light bulb recycler. I want to say that I support the bill, and I want you all to understand that in the nation, not just in Minnesota, but in the nation, our recycling is really in place. We are prepared for more recycling. We're estimating about 25% recycling rate on the light bulbs, and we'd like to see that rise considerably, obviously. As both of these gentlemen have referred to, this isn't everything that we need to see. We need to see more enforcement as well. I know that's not a part of the bill, but I just want to throw that out there for future consideration when we're looking for more enforcement to get these recycling rates at looking better. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
And Mr.
Sir Buzz Anderson, did you wish to sit and support this bill? Oh.
Is that for me?
It's for you. No, you're not. No.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers, and I just asked Senator Marty if that patch in his neck was because of me being a pain in the neck. But first of all, I want to say thanks to Karen Skoog and her organization and also Senator Marty for reaching out and trying to work with us on this sign issue, and that's what I'm here to talk about today is the sign requirement on retailers. we have a couple concerns about this. Retailers generally have concerns about signs because every time there's a sign requirement for something, there's another legal obligation or regulatory requirement put on a business. And particularly if you're the small grocer or hardware store, whether it's in Wells or Park Rapids or Egan or you name it, you have a lot of turnover in staff, and the sign might fall down and maybe get a new manager, and the sign doesn't get put back up. Well, now who's responsible, and who knew the sign was supposed to go back up? So that's one set of problems all by itself. More importantly, the same retailer that he just talked about, Walmart, has had a nationwide effort also to try to give these CFLs, these energy-efficient light bulbs, away in low-income areas. And guess what? People won't take them. They won't even take them free. And the reason they won't take them free is because they have a different color hue, they have a different shape, so people don't know how to put light shades on them and so on and so forth. And I know this was not Senator Marnie's intent, but when the bill first came out, there was actually a requirement in the bill that the sign be in 100-point type, and I actually made one up, and it was 3 feet long and 18 inches high.
Yeah, but that's so not in this one. So.
Beg your pardon?
We're not talking about that.
That's true.
On to what we got.
But we aren't. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we are talking about a sign requirement, and that's our concern. We don't want to scare people away from buying these, and we're afraid those who will read it will, in fact, be scared away. They cost about $7. The ones that I bought recently already say on the box, this contains mercury. Please recycle in accordance with your local sign, with your local community ordinances. So we think that and the efforts by Walmart, the marketplace, what utilities are doing by putting information in people's utility bills to tell them that they need to recycle their energy-efficient light bulbs is adequate. And so we'd ask you to eliminate that provision of the bill. We certainly support the provision of the bill. We support mercury reduction. We support energy-efficient standards in Minnesota. We just don't like the sign requirement. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
All right. Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions about the bill, Senator Marty. I understand the concerns from the retailers, but I wonder about some of the concerns of the manufacturer. We don't have any of the manufacturers present today, it looks like. Do we?
I think we do.
Actually, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonif, I don't know that we have any manufacturers present, but we have worked through Lloyd Grooms, who has represented quite a few of the manufacturers, on coming up with the amendment language that we have right here. So we don't have any manufacturers in the room, but we have.
Okay. The questions I would have, for example, on section number 3, line 3.8 to 3.12, saying that you have to put all these hazards and such in the 12-point type in print or online media, audibly conveyed in television and radio advertisements, stipulating what has to be put in a TV commercial is, it reminds me of the pharmaceutical ads where they tell you the benefits of this great medicine and then they tell you every which way that you could be killed if you take this medicine. And so I'm concerned about actually saying that, it's important that we convert average citizens to use these types of products, and I'm concerned that we're being a little heavy-handed in our language here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lloyd Grooms. I'm an attorney with the law firm Winthrop & Weinstein, represent the National Electronic Manufacturers Association. First of all, Senator Marty has worked with us, and in the language that you see before you, including the recent amendment that changed sold to manufactured, was in terms of accommodating the manufacturers. The particular provision that you're referring to is actually requirement on utilities, not on manufacturers. The manufacturer's requirements as to labeling and notice is actually in a earlier provision which referenced the work that we do with the clearinghouse, the IMERC clearinghouse. And if we have a plan that has been approved in another state, an IMERC state, then that plan, and we're in compliance with that plan, we are in compliance in the state of Minnesota. That's one of the provisions that we wanted so that we would have a national approach to this, and Senator Marty has incorporated that into the bill.
Okay.
I think your question is probably more directed at the utilities.
And Senator Marty, do you know how the utilities feel about having to, and if they have a 30-second spot, and that's generally people buy 30-second spots, 45-second, if they have to put in this audible television and radio advertisement, do you have a sense of their response to that?
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen any Excel or other ads, television ads, encouraging people to buy a compact for fluorescent low amps. If they do, they would have to have a little thing in there. Again, just to get back, like, for instance, the retail store concern, again, we share the concern. We're saying we want people to buy them. Fluorescent lamps save energy and help reduce pollution in the environment. Note, the lamps contain mercury and should be recycled, basically is what we're saying. And just for comparison, I mean, we do, this is for used motor oil, current law. You'll notice similarities in size. This is what's required for auto batteries in state law. We're trying to make it consistent with that in terms of how we do it. We're trying not to be onerous. In terms of Mr. Anderson's concerns, again, we gave them the exception that it sounds like Target and Walmart and some of the big manufacturers are doing, where instead of putting any sign up, they can have a recycle bin there to take back fluorescent, compact fluorescents. We're trying to be reasonable in that. And again, I think Excel is a customer. I remember getting some flyers inserted in Bill saying, here, you can buy compact fluorescents. They save energy and so on. We're just saying if you're going to do that, put a little notice there saying that these things contain mercury. And we're not trying to discourage them from selling because, again, we want them to sell them. We want them to be promoted. We just want to make sure they realize it's illegal to put it in the – you're supposed to recycle.
Senator Marty, I still – I guess – you know, having been in both manufacturing and retail and been involved in having to create TV commercials, I still am concerned that we are saying in law it has to be audibly conveyed in television and radio advertisements, whether, you know, perhaps putting it on the screen. Could you take out that word audibly and say conveyed? I mean,
Mr.
that's
Chairman,
just a very...
Right. I understand, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, that it's not a big concern because I don't think they are. If you want to take out the word audibly, that's reasonable. I don't think we're going to be seeing a lot of them because there's so much promotion of compact fluorescence in a variety of ways. I haven't been seeing any ads or reading any ads buying compact fluorescence other than their bill flyers and so on. But if you want to strike the word audibly, I understand. I don't think it's a big difference because realistically.
Thank you. And then with regard to the retail stores, I did have a conversation, and I agree that there should be signing. I think that's very important, and I think we just have to work carefully to make sure that how we're suggesting the signs be actually worded does not, in fact, scare our consumers. And so I think that we ought to work carefully with the retailers. But I do agree with you that there should be signage.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, again, if you have any suggestions for improving the wording, but, again, the first thing we start is fluorescent lamps save energy and help reduce pollution to the environment. So that's the goal we're trying to get across. And if you have any suggestions, we're open to it. This was an attempt to do that, and I think that's not a concern we're hearing from the stores. They just don't like the idea of a sign, period.
Yes, I know. Thank you.
Senator Bonhoff, did you want to pursue that word, to take it out?
Mr. Chair, I would. I don't think we ought to say how they should advertise that. Just
that's
if
on
we
line 310.
Delete the word audible.
And the author is not averse to that. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
I was just... considering whether or not the signage, which I think is a good idea, ought to include language to the effect that these devices will save consumers money in the long run as well. I mean, if we're concerned about, you know, they may be concerned about the environment and they want to do the right thing, but the cost is going to be an important factor in deciding whether or not to buy something. And when you average out the cost, that's important. So just toss out the idea.
And, Mr. Chair, and Senator Latz, if I may respond, the language that we have in the required here is just kind of a minimum. As we state, the retailers in line 2.18 of the amendment, retailers may include additional language in the notice if they choose, if they would like to say they promote the sale because of the energy saving or anything else they want to say, that's fine with us. We just, you know, felt strongly about the mercury content language inclusion. So thank you.
Okay, further discussion? Senator Anderson? Representative Anderson?
Thank you. That was a long time ago.
You're not there anymore.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not.
Well, that's her. That's what I'm thinking of. Senator Anderson, she got the next bill up.
Are we?
Your cousins? First cousins?
She called me your dad last year, Mr. Chair, by the way. Mr. Chair and members, first of all, we are not the first state to wrestle with the sign issue. A lot of states are very concerned about the unintended consequence of scaring people away, particularly on a new product that's more expensive. When they see the word mercury, they're not going to want to buy them. Yeah, there's mercury in the light, the regular fluorescent light bulbs, but people already know they have to recycle them. I think it's going to take some time for people to learn how to do that. But again, other states are trying to figure out what's a better method than a sign. And in fact, the state of Maine has got language adopted now that has actually set up a study committee to figure out what's the best way to inform consumers. We don't think that signs are the best way. I might also add that when Senator Marty was talking about Target and Best Buy, I don't know this for sure, but they don't have a take-back program. The program that they use that Mr. Larson was talking about is for the light bulbs that they use within all of their stores. I don't think it's for customer take-back. It's actually for their own industrial use. I applaud them for doing that. I think it's a good idea. But I don't think, really, signs in this way it's presented in the bill are going to do anything but scare customers away, and I think you'll have the unintended consequence of having the opposite effect of what we all want.
All right.
Chair.
Senator Sparksy.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I know we want to kind of keep moving, but I think that Mr. Anderson does bring up some good points. So I would move that we delete Section 17 of the A6 amendment.
Was that to take out the sign?
Take out the sign requirement, Mr. Chair.
All right, that's Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly again, this is what we require for used oil. This is what we require for batteries. This is what we want to require for fluorescent lamps. It starts out with an encouragement to buy, and I don't think that's an unreasonable approach to doing it. Obviously, the committee can do what it wishes, but I do think that we've been trying to, for the last several months, try and come up with something. We do give them the option of take-back program, putting a bin out there. I believe that's what the witness, I had not heard from him earlier, but that's what he said Walmart is agreeing to do beginning in June. That's all I know about it.
Okay, I think we know pretty much what the amendment does. Senator Latz, did you have it?
I would just add, you know, I consider myself reasonably well-informed as a consumer, pay attention to stuff like that. And Senator Bonhoff and I were just commenting, we've purchased fluorescent light bulbs at retail stores and didn't realize there was this problem. We just tossed them in the garbage. We didn't know. But if you're going to buy it at the retail store and you see the sign right there, you're going to know. You're going to have 100% penetration on the market in terms of that information, or as close to it as you can get. I don't see any alternative.
Okay, on the Sparks amendment to delete, what is it, section
17.
I think we know what it does. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No. Amendment prevails. Further discussion? Pardon?
Division.
Okay. All those in.
Well, the amendment prevailed. I'm sorry. I misheard. I don't want division.
He used to be my close personal friend, and this is the second time he's picked on me in a month.
Division. All right.
I'm going to come forward. Do you have anybody else who wish to testify on the bill, for or against?
I said division, Mr. Chair.
Well, you know, I don't know who's. Why am I looking at you? She's one. These guys are. Somebody says yes and somebody says no, so we're going to raise our hands. All those in favor,
Raise your hand. Okay, I bet my hearing's pretty good. You wait and see. All those opposed? I'll try it again. To make sure. All right, the motion does prevail.
I know.
Schoenfeld, did you wish to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I'm working with the Minnesota Pork Producers Association. And I first of all want to apologize to Senator Marty because I hadn't talked to him about this earlier. I was called into this a couple hours ago, so a little late on it. But in any case, my concern is Section 10 of the bill, which deals with the section that deals with animal over-the-counter sales, of banning over-the-counter sales of animal pharmaceuticals. And I have with me an email that came to me last evening, which prompted me to be involved in this. And it was contact with the USDA veterinarians. And they did a search of the number of pharmaceuticals or a number of vaccines that contain thimerosal, which is one of the things that would be banned here. And my email states is that there are 774 products which contain thimerosal out of 3,051 total vaccinations. The reason the swine producers are particularly concerned about this is that there is a number of those that are used for swine flu, and it's very commonly used in the production system to vaccinate for swine flu. Now, there are a couple of things I'd like to say about this. First of all, it's a vaccination, so it's pretty much a one-time shot versus an antibiotic type of situation where you might do it over and over and again. So the amounts are very small. And the other concern that we have about it is that what bans is over-the-counter sales. And so what that means is not that the vaccine is totally banned, but what it means is we can't go down to Fleet Farm and buy it. Instead, we have to go through a veterinarian. And you can imagine that if we have to go through a veterinarian versus going down to Fleet Farm and buying the vaccine that we would give ourselves, it would increase the cost significantly. And so that's the concern. I apologize for not having discussed this with the senator before, and would hope that we could maybe review that.
Mr. Chairman, we did not intend to include vaccinations here, and for human ones, you don't buy over-the-counter vaccinations. So I will suggest that the committee strike or animal on page 5, line 2, because the intent was, again, to get
Is that Senator Murphy's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's it.
We're going to give you some credit for this one. So we're going to give the language. What is it? Strike just four animals? Okay, everybody understand the amendment? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Further amendments? Further discussion on the bill? Senator Letts.
In light of the fact that there is no longer a signage requirement, I'm wondering what the proposal would be in the context of the bill to make sure that consumers know that these fluorescent light bulbs contain mercury and they ought to be recycled, including whether or not consideration was given to a mandatory consumer take-back program by retailers who sell these products.
Is there something on the packaging that remains? Or tell us what...
Mr. Chair and members, the language that remains is the labeling language that is a requirement for manufacturers. At this point, there are no requirements in this bill for retailers to do any kind of educating or notifying.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman, can you, Ms. Skou, can you point me to that language in the bill? Is it going to be small print legal disclaimer stuff on the packaging, or is it going to be larger that someone might actually see when they're buying the product?
Basically, it is. It's if you look at the amendment, the A6 amendment, the labeling requirements are 1.7 through 1.11. And as a part of it's in Section 2 of the original amendment. And basically it just states that the labeling must be in accordance with the labeling plans approved in other IMERC states. So it doesn't really have any other specificity, although I understand most of the IMERC states have a 10-point font minimum on their labeling, I believe.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Salzman.
Yes. You know, there are two bulbs sitting on my desk at home that I don't know what to do with. And so in my mind, the reason that I voted against this sign is that I think, you know, if we really look at this as consumer-driven, I'm going to go back and buy bulbs at stores that offer the recycling. And so hearing that Walmart is doing something like this, to me, is a way for the industry and our retailers to kind of drive this to say, I offer these kinds of recycling programs. And then consumers are going to go to those stores to repurchase bulbs. So, I mean, to me, that's more effective because if I see that sign, I'm probably not going to buy the bulb. But knowing where I can go to recycle it is going to help me to use the bulbs and know where to take them. So, I mean, to that point, perhaps, that's what I see consumers doing in this respect.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Latch.
I guess two things. One is I'm looking at the original bill, lines 2.27. Is that the labeling requirement for the manufacturer?
Mr. Chairman, or was that deleted? That's what it was, but we're replacing that with the language of the IMARC language. So, in other words, okay. if it's approved by one of the states that have that that plan, that they would have to, and again, I think she said it's 10-point type. We had 12-point type. But,
okay.
Again, I think Senator Salzman's point is well taken. The point we're concerned is we want to make sure consumers know that they're not supposed to be disposing them. They're supposed to be recycling them. And I think manufacturers, as retailers begin doing that, I think consumers will become aware of it. And, I mean, one of our goals is to make sure consumers know they're not supposed to be tossing them in the trash.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Response to Senator Salzman's point. She may be a more diligent consumer than I think most people buying light bulbs who probably pick them up as they're in whatever store they're in, picking up other items. I would suggest probably very few consumers make a special trip to the store for the purpose of buying a load of fluorescent light bulbs, but maybe more should. That's why I guess took a different position on that amendment. I guess the other question I had, was there any consideration given to mandating consumer take-back programs among the retailers? I know this discussion was had within the last several years with regard to electronics sales, and I don't recall where that ended up, or I think it never – I'm not sure what happened with it, but how about in this case?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, we still haven't resolved all of that. Senator Higgins has some legislation on that. This one, in the amendment that was in the bill, we actually – we're encouraging that by saying you could avoid the sign totally if you'd take back. And obviously, if we can't get it in as an alternative to it, trying it on its own would not likely fly. But I agree with you. I think we ought to be doing that. I think in the future it may happen. But we're taking one step at a time, I guess.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'll just note it's me a whole lot easier when one of my fluorescent light bulbs goes out for me to toss it in the garbage. I'm not saying I'm going to. I'll make the special trip, but I would think the average consumer might just say it's easier to toss it in the garbage. Yeah. I don't know any better. It'll get picked up.
Senator Latz, I agree with you, but I think we're beyond that. The amendment to take that stuff out was adopted. So, Senator Scheid.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Marty, I have looked at this kind of a cursory way. I don't see anything about recycling centers, but isn't this the kind of thing that I could take to my local recycling center? My community does that very aggressively. Is that something we can do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, actually there is within the first section related to recycling, lines 2.15 through 2.19 outline some of the places, including lamp recycling facilities, household hazardous waste collection facilities, and some of the additional language that was added as part of the amendment includes retailer take back and utility provider program sites, so we do specify some of the particular places that they can be recycled.
It's 2.5 to 2.9, not...
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be the appropriate place to make the effort to inform people. My community does inform us, and it seems to me we just got something saying they need more recycled paper, for example. That was in our city newsletter.
Really?
There's a shortage now of paper for recycling. So they're very aggressive. I think that in the Twin Cities area, communities, I certainly would hope that you'd be encouraging the information to consumers this way, that way.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and I know my city does as well, and I think we want to encourage as many ways of communicating with the public, and there's still a lot in this bill that's very valuable to help do that, so I appreciate that.
Okay, any further discussion on the bill? Does somebody wish to move the bill? For Senator Murphy moves that Senate file 1085 be recommended to pass and goes right to the floor. As amended, yeah. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Thank
Next
you,
bill,
Chairman.
Senator, you're welcome. Senator Higgins. And try to pick up the pace here a little bit if we can and still do our work proper fashion.
Mr. Chair, we have a delete all amendment if we could have it passed out. If somebody could give me a copy of it.
But
Thanks.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it gets into water.
Okay. Senator Rosen will move that A1 amendment to get the bill into shape that the author would like it. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Higgins on the bill as amended. Senator.
Mr. Chair and members, radon is a deadly gas that is very prevalent in the upper Midwest and in Minnesota. What this bill would do would have the Commissioner of Labor and Industry adopt rules for radon control as part of the building code.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that 1735 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Senate floor.
Any buddy in opposition to the bill in the audience? Or? Okay. Any further discussion on the bill? If not, Senator Murphy renews his motion that Senate file 1735 be recommended to pass and go to the floor. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Tomasoni, did you have some people from came to town or something? Senator Tomasoni,
what is this?
This is number 8 on our agenda, which is Senate File 514. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 514 is related to unpaid work for cash assistance, and it prohibits it. And what this refers to is its language in the employment law, which prohibits employment of a person under conditions requiring them to work for no wages in return for cash assistance under the MFIP program. And the bill in front of you also allows an employee to voluntarily agree in writing to do so, and that individual may terminate the unpaid work agreement at any time. What this is about is just making sure that people who are on MFIP are working and are actually getting paid. And so I have some witnesses, Mr. Chairman, and they can tell you what we're talking about here.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and state your name and for the record.
Hi, my name is Angel Buchner, and I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. I'm just going to read our statement about workfare. The Welfare Rights Committee is completely opposed to workfare. Workfare forces parents into poverty to work for no pay in order to receive the monthly welfare grant. Senator Tomasoni's bill, Senate File 514, will prohibit workfare in Minnesota. It allows parents to do voluntary work if that is their choice, but it must truly be voluntary. First and foremost, workfare is a labor issue. Workfare is not just about families on welfare. It's It's about all workers in this state. The impact of workfare on the entire working population is devastating. Workfare serves to drive down wages overall by creating free forced labor force. Workfare displaces decent paying jobs and workers. Often these jobs are union jobs. For example, in New York City, the Parks Department cut its maintenance staff, which were union jobs, by 40% over a four-year period, replacing them with workfare workers. Workfare is a direct attack on working people as a whole, on organized labor, and on organizing efforts. Once businesses, whether for-profit or non-profit, public or private, know they can get workers who are forced to work for free, there is no reason for them to keep paid employees or to pay decent wages. Why would a boss continue to pay someone to do a job if he or she can go down to the welfare office and get someone to work for free? Citing recent federal changes, the Minnesota Department of Human Services has opened the door to large-scale usage of workfare in Minnesota. In Hennepin County alone, over 700 welfare recipients already have been forced to work at jobs for free. Governor Pawlenty has opposed changing current law and mandating workfare statewide for everyone in the beginning months of welfare assistance. He also proposes workfare as the solution to meet work requirements and proposing setting up workfare sites in both the private and public sector. If workfare is allowed to take root in Minnesota, it will be a disaster for all working people. We urge senators to pass Senate File 514 and prohibit workfare in Minnesota. If there is a job to be done, it should be made into a real job with a real wage. Thank you.
Okay, do we have another witness? Did you wish to?
Yes.
Ms. Weldon?
Hello, my name is Virginia Weldon. I'm also with the Welfare Rights Committee. I'm a recent recipient of welfare and a mother of two. I am here to testify about my experience of being forced to work for free while I was receiving welfare. I had been working at a job for many years, but because of surgery and medical conditions that I still am suffering from, I was forced to leave my job and go on welfare in order to support my family. While receiving welfare, I participated in different training programs and did job search for 20 to 40 hours per week. But after months and months of repeated job search, I was given only one interview, was never accepted for a job, and received dozens of rejection letters. In March of 2005, I was forced to work for free for over 5 months in order to receive my welfare grant, which was $387 a month. My job counselor threatened me with sanctions or cuts to my welfare grant and told me that I had to do volunteer work because I couldn't find paid employment, like it was my fault that no one would hire me. I was forced to work for 33.75 hours per week for no pay at a nonprofit. To add insult to my injury, after 5 months of working for free, when I hit my welfare limit, the place I was working for let me go and hired a different person to do the exact same job I was, but for pay. This is a clear example of how the welfare is not about getting us jobs to get out of poverty. It is about pushing poor women into free labor or low-wage labor and trapping us into poverty for life. Thank you.
Okay, did you have
one more?
One more?
Phyllis Walker, president of Ask Me Local 3800, representing the clerical workers at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I bring you greetings from Ask Me Local 3800. Labor organizations in Minnesota are standing up against Governor Pawlenty's plan to require the people of the state who are forced to support their families with welfare to work in jobs with no salary in order to receive their welfare grant. As word spreads, these labor organizations are taking a stand. They're taking a stand against workfare. The labor organizations that have taken formal positions against workfare so far are SEIU, Service Employees International Union, UNITE, HERE, the United Food and Commercial Workers. That's UFCW 789, representing 7,500 workers in Minnesota. AsME Local 8, representing 800 public employees in Minnesota. AsME Local 3800, representing 1,600 clerical workers at the University of Minnesota. AsME Council 5, representing 40,000 public employees in Minnesota. St. Paul Trades and Labor, representing 40,000 workers for many different unions in St. Paul. And the Minnesota AFL-CIO, representing 300,000 workers in Minnesota. If workfare is allowed to continue, not only will working people suffer, but the economy of Minnesota will suffer as well. As an elected representative of the clerical workers of the University of Minnesota, I urge you to act in the best interest of the state of Minnesota and to put an end to workfare. Now, when I consider my job as a clerical worker at the U, I know that after working there 20 years, my wages are much lower than they would be if I had spent those 20 years in the private sector. And honestly, I feel somewhat cheated as I move towards retirement. But when I talk to the people who I know who are forced to receive welfare in order to support their families, I realize that they would give anything to have the job that I have. Welfare recipients want to work. They want to have health insurance. They want to earn vacation and sick leave, and they deserve to be paid a living wage. Unfortunately, in our economy, there aren't enough living wage jobs to go around, and that is why some of us are forced to support our families with welfare. It is not by choice, it is by necessity. And it is in the best interest of the people and the economy of the state of Minnesota to stop workfare now. Thank you.
Any questions of the witnesses or the presenter of the bill? Any opposition from the audience? Anybody here to speak against the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Michelle.
Mr. Chair, we've heard a lot of bills this year. I think this is the first one we've heard on welfare issues. Is there anyone here from the Department of Human Services? Is there anyone that can give us a little more background from an administration standpoint?
Would that be you? Welcome to the committee. And
hello, my name is Jane DeLage, and I work for the Department of Human Services. Thank you. Perhaps if I could get a little better sense of the question.
Michelle, Senator Michelle, would
thank you?
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get a better sense of the bill. And we've just heard some fairly critical comments about workfare. Maybe you could help explain what's the state's
position
piece in that, and then I think we also heard some comments about the governor and the executive branch's position on this kind of legislation. If you could shed some light on those, it would be very helpful for us.
Okay. As part of our efforts to meet the work participation rate requirements that are part of the federal TANF law, which have been strengthened under the Deficit Reduction Act, one of the proposals that was in the governor's proposal was to increase some funding for unpaid work. And unpaid work is used primarily for people who are unable to find regular employment, who may need some time to build a resume by working in a position that is unpaid and getting some experience as a worker. At this point, we have about 3% of the people who are making the work participation rate as of April of 06, were working in unpaid work experience positions. Those positions are subject to the Fair Labor Standards Act, so the people cannot be required to work more than the state minimum wage, their grant divided by the state minimum wage. So that is something that is a protection there. There's also some language in statute that limits displacement of regular workers. That this statute has been in place for quite some time. I'm trying to see now if I left that behind. That would be Section 256J.72, which talks about non-displacement in work activities. Generally, these are short-term positions, or they may be short hours that supplement someone who's working in other countable activities, but to add enough hours for them to count toward the work participation rate. This is something that we're exploring as a way to both help people to build a work history and to increase hours of workers so that they can meet the work participation rate. And as I said, as of last year, at this time, we had about 3% of the people who were in our work participation rate were working in unpaid work. And we anticipate that that might increase because we have put some additional funding toward unpaid work from our innovation funds with the consolidated fund. And there was some additional funding for innovation. And this year, we funded both transportation programs and unpaid work programs. If there's any other specific questions.
I'm trying to listen. I take it that the department is not in favor of the legislation. Is that what I'm getting out of this?
The governor's proposal supports some additional funding for unpaid work. So this bill would restrict what the governor's proposal.
Okay, I thought I heard Senator Boniff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
My name is Jane DeLage.
Thank you, Ms. DeLage. With regard to what the person who testified saying that she worked 33 and a half, whatever, per week, and that what she received in cash benefit was $375 a month, that certainly sounds exploitative. Can you address that?
Senator Bonham, yes, I think that it's become it became more clear with the passage of the Deficit Reduction Act that we really need to look at the Fair Labor Standards and that does apply. Fair Labor Standards Act does apply to these positions. So we have issued additional guidance on the application of the Fair Labor Standards to these positions, and there is now a provision in the federal law that allows for deeming of hours so that if someone is working enough hours to if you divide their grant by the minimum wage, then they can be considered to have met the TANF work requirements even if they aren't working the full TANF hours. So I think that we've issued some clarifications on that. It may not all have been in place at the time that this individual was working. We will be looking at the application of Fair Labor Standards to unpaid work. But we can count these people even if they aren't working a full 20 or 30 hours because the federal law now allows us to deem them as meeting the requirements if they're working enough hours to qualify to cover their grant.
Mr. Chair, so you're saying that now the law has been corrected and that could never happen?
Well, I would never say never, but certainly we have given guidance to the counties and we will be looking at that. We do have in our systems a way that we can look at whether the grants, whether the hours exceed the grant.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I am just disheartened to hear that could still even be a possibility. And I think that Senator Tomasoni is bringing this forward because it sounds like we don't have proper protections for workers. And so I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, I think, as I said, I think that we are doing what we can to make sure that counties are aware of and applying the Fair Labor Standards Act to what to the work that's being required of people, and that we do have some systems edits now that we'll be able to identify where that is occurring, and we will then work with counties to rectify that situation. So it's certainly our goal to not have that happening.
Senator Neville.
Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions. First, I just want to make clear to myself, is this a this work requirement, is that a federal requirement, or is this something that we're doing on our own at the state level?
There's a federal requirement that people be engaged in work activities. There are different activities that qualify. Of course, paid work is the preferred activity, but when people are unable to obtain paid work, then they may participate in unpaid work experience in order to meet their work requirements. There are some other activities that also count toward their work requirements. The word that we get from the field is that this is a way that they are able to get people experience that they need in order to then successfully apply for paid work, and that in some cases they are picked up by the agency or entity that they are working in.
Mr. Chair, that's too complex an answer.
I'm sorry.
My question. It sounds like the work fair is not required by federal law, then there are options that we have. Is that correct?
Unpaid work is one activity. It is not required per se, but being engaged in these acceptable activities.
So if Mr. Chair, if we did not do the work fair, would there be any possible jeopardy of our TANF money?
Well, we believe that that not doing unpaid work would result in a decrease in our work participation rate, and that would put us at jeopardy of penalties from the federal government. Okay. That this is one of the ways that we can help to meet the work participation rate.
And Mr. Chairman, my last question is: for the people who are doing the unpaid work, do they get? I mean, they're using their welfare dollars now for getting to work, transportation dollars. Do they get paid anything for that?
There is support funding in the consolidated fund, so they can be given some assistance for transportation. They receive child care. They can get uniforms or other.
So over and above their normal monthly grant, they could get extra money to get to work if they have to do an unpaid job?
Yes, that there's some funding available for that.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, one of the things that's going on here is that when people are on welfare, the idea is to get them to work and to get them off of welfare. And when they are forced to work in this work fair thing without any pay, it doesn't do anything for them. It doesn't get them up out of their doldrums and get them into a job because they're not making any money. So they're being forced to go to work to meet whatever these requirements are just to get their little grant, but they're not making any money at the job that they're at. And so it doesn't do anything for their self-esteem or their ability to actually transform into society and become productive citizens. And so what we're trying to do here is say that that we want them to work for money. If they decide that they voluntarily will work for free, they can if they want to. That's allowed in the legislation, and so they can sign off on it and meet some kind of requirements, but what the bill's trying to do is to say that if you want to work for cash, then you should be allowed to, and you don't have to be forced into the work fair. And maybe we got some better explanation.
I have some clarifying points as well, if I may.
State your name. and
My name is Deb Konichny. I'm also a member of the Welfare Rights Committee. To start with, in response to the federal regulations that has been brought up, there is a bill moving through the Senate right now that will get the state in compliance with federal regulations without using any workfare at all. The proposal that has been put forward by Governor Pawlenty to open the door widespread and even mandate workfare is not moving at all. So Senator Berglund has been working on a number of provisions that will get the state in compliance with federal regulations using other things. And there are many other options to workfare, such as subsidized employment, which is for pay, on-the-job training, which is for pay, getting an actual job for pay. So we support anything that involves pay. We are utterly opposed to anything that does not involve pay. And again, it is not just a welfare issue. That's why it's being heard in this committee. It really is a labor issue. If you look at the states that opened the door to workfare, you will see a destruction of paying jobs in those states, of putting workfare workers into place of decent paying jobs, and they're there working off welfare grants. And that is wrong. So it won't just hurt our families in poverty. It also hurts all of the workers in the state. And that is it's a much bigger issue. Also, I just wanted to say, again, that voluntary work
is allowed in the bill. So if somebody voluntarily does it, wants to do volunteer work, they can do that. But there is no threat of having their welfare grant cut or this hanging over their head, which is really life and death issues in this state. If your housing is being held over your head, if you're not going to work for free, then you're going to, you know, you have some very hard choices to make. It shouldn't be that way. Welfare families have a lot of work experience. If you've never been on welfare, you might not understand that, but we work every day. Just being on welfare is a lot of work to jump through all the hoops to get a cash grant that keeps us 62% below the poverty level. So we have a lot of work experience. We know how to do these things. What we want is jobs that pay living wages that will get us off welfare so we don't have to keep living in poverty, because that's where welfare keeps us. And one final point I wanted to say is that we could be effectively forced to work for free. There is a time limit on welfare. It's a 5-year lifetime limit. And what is happening, like with Virginia, she was forced to work for free, hit the time limit, and then she was fired from that free job, and someone else was hired into that position. We could effectively work our whole 5-year limit for free, never get a decent paying job, and then what are we supposed to do? We're just out of luck. Whereas if this program is really to help us get out of poverty and get jobs so we can be off welfare, it should be helping us get jobs that pay with benefits so we can get off welfare.
All right, Senator Saltzman and then Senator Scheid, and probably we know the issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, because I was briefed on this on Monday in my own community on MFIP and some of the programs and how they work together, if there was a clause in here that said you did not work for cash assistance unless it was at the minimum wage, would that be helpful? So people don't feel that they should have to work for any of these benefits or to gain work experience during this time if there's a problem?
Okay, who can answer that?
I'm just unclear here.
I can answer that. There are work requirements. Everyone on welfare has work requirements if able to work. Mm-hmm. What we are opposed to is being forced to work for free. The time clock is ticking, and we are getting nowhere. So what we are opposed to is unpaid free labor. There are many other options are work requirements.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, but what I just asked was that if you take out work for free but paid, you know, if your welfare assistance is equal to the number of hours that you were working at a minimum wage, that's what I'm struggling with here.
Senator Scheid.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm wanting to know, where are these jobs coming from? Are they being taken from someone? Are they being created as make work? What is this? And I'm not sure, Senator Saltzman, that minimum wage would necessarily cover, would be the normal wage for whatever job we're talking that people have. I'm aghast. So I'd like to know where these jobs are coming from, Senator Tomasoni, or.
Where are the jobs right now in Minnesota? A lot of the jobs are with nonprofits. Some are make-work jobs. They really don't give any experience that's going to be useful at all for getting a decent-paying job. Some are replacing definitely their jobs, like what Virginia was in. When she hit her limit, they hired someone into that same job for $10 an hour. So some of them are replacing and giving nonprofits a cut. But in other states, it hasn't been just nonprofits. And Governor Pawlenty's proposal is to increase that to the private and public sector. And so they could be your jobs at grocery stores or at Walmarts. It directly counters even organizing efforts by, you know, unions that are trying to get better wages for the workers that are actually there that aren't getting very decent wages. It's very counter. Like was said, in New York City, over 30,000 Parks Department jobs were lost to workfare workers. They were union jobs. So there's a lot of statistics about why this is wrong for the whole workforce as well as for poor families.
All right. Any other discussion on the bill?
Chairman, I move Senate File 514 be recommended to pass.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail. Senator
Thank you.
Anderson, minimum wage. We got a lot of easy ones today.
I got an easy one.
You have a reasonable.
I got an easy
coming from
one.
You.
I can't believe that. Yeah. I can't believe it.
I actually didn't read the big one. All right.
What's wrong with this picture?
Yeah, why doesn't everyone come up now? Yeah, I think it's easier. Yeah.
Okay. Senate file number 4 on the agenda, number Senate file 875.
I've been waiting away for a while, I would guess.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm really proud to be here with the bill to raise the minimum wage. And the Minnesota Senate for many years has, I've been in the Senate for 15 years, and I know for many, many years we've supported strong policies that reward work. And I had no idea I'd be following Senator Tomasoni, so this is just accidental. But always supported policies that allow the people of Minnesota to be self-sufficient and encourage them to be able to support themselves and their families through their participation in the workforce. And in order to do that, we need to have a fair and reasonable minimum wage in place so that people who do go to work are able to bring home enough money that they can have a hope of paying the bills and supporting their families and maintaining self-sufficiency and not having to rely on government programs or government assistance. In 2005, we increased the minimum wage to $6.15 an hour, and that increase did not come all that close to restoring all the money lost to inflation over the last 30 years. If the minimum wage had kept pace with inflation since the 1960s, which was its high point, it would now be at over $9 an hour. $9.27 an hour is what the minimum wage should be if it had kept up with inflation. And what that means is that people's earning power who are working minimum wage jobs obviously has not kept up with inflation. And so that causes real hardship for individuals who are working hard to try to support themselves. In Minnesota, we have over 400,000 jobs that pay less than $9 an hour. In other words, jobs that are not keeping up with inflation for the ability to pay those basic costs. And we have a handout, which has any of them gone out yet? About the district by district?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
what's being handed out right now. And this will tell you in your own Senate district how many of your constituents are working at jobs that pay under $7.75 an hour. And so this tells you how many people that you represent you could give a raise today by voting for this bill. And I will tell you that it will be very popular with your constituents and with people across the state of Minnesota. This is an issue that has always enjoyed very broad bipartisan support across the state and the country. And I hope it does here in the Capitol as well. The most recent survey data that we have from Minnesota, from the Minnesota State Survey in 2005, after the last increase, after the increase to $6.15 an hour, said that about 70% of Minnesotans still believe that it was too low, that the minimum wage is too low. We believe that the minimum wage, as we've traditionally done in our legislature, must be increased for all workers. That means no tip penalty, no penalty for those who work at a job where they receive tips. That would essentially create two classes of workers and say that the tipped employees are going to have to stay flat and not get an increase while others do. We know that typical servers are across the board on average are not getting rich at those jobs and spend many hours performing non-tipped work. We know that in Minnesota, as a matter of fact, the median wage for tipped workers, including for servers in Minnesota, including their tips, is $6.88 an hour. So that includes their tips. And so for a large business, that's 38 cents above. No, not 38 cents, sorry. That's about 50 cents above the minimum wage. We always hear concerns about being an island and being the only state. So I want to tell you things are moving. The minimum wage is on the march. across the country, and state after state after state has passed increases in the last couple of years. At this point, there are now 29 other states plus the District of Columbia that have higher minimums than the federal government. The feds are still, the national minimum wage is still at $5.15 an hour. But there are also 25 states, exactly half the states, have higher minimum wages than Minnesota right now. And we pride ourselves in this state at having a well-trained workforce, at having high incomes, and having a prosperous and successful workforce and prosperous and successful economy. And I think a really important part of that high road type of economic strategy that Minnesota has excelled at is that we have a floor that is a decent floor. So we don't want to be in the bottom half of the states around the nation in our minimum wage. And we also know that our neighbors are getting ahead of us. So it's not just other parts of the country. Iowa, Wisconsin, and Illinois, among our immediate neighbors, already have higher minimum wages than Minnesota does. Even Arkansas's minimum wage. We always like to pick on some southern state, and today we'll pick on Arkansas. Their minimum wage is higher than Minnesotan right now. Let me tell you what the bill would do. There's other points I can make, but they will certainly come up as we go forward and through our witnesses. So I won't spend a lot more time. I know you have a very busy agenda. Let me tell you what the bill would do. It would, first of all, repeal the sub-minimum wage category that exists for those individuals under age 20 for their first 90 days of work, the youth wage. This is still at $4.90 an hour, so it's a really low sub-minimum wage. So we think it's time for an increase to that. We didn't increase that in 2005. So the bill would raise that, or it would just repeal it, so they would just be put in the same category as other workers. We would raise the minimum wage for large businesses in Minnesota to from $6.15 to $6.75 this year on August 1st, and then to $7.75 on August 1st, 2008. And for the small businesses, we would raise it from $5.25 to $5.75 in the first jump, and the second jump it would raise to $6.75. So you'd end up with a two-tier, $7.75, $6.75. And I should point out that one of the other parts of the compromise bill that passed in 2005 was to increase the cap for what we call a small business. So we raised that significantly without actually raising the small business wage. And so now our small business threshold is $625,000 or under is considered a small business. And I think that's the most expansive definition of a small business anywhere in the country. So we have a very expansive definition, but we need to make sure that those workers are not really far left behind, because that's a lot of workers in Minnesota. The bill also indexes the minimum wage to inflation, which we have not done before, and that's why I keep coming back. And we will continue to come back every couple of years if we don't index this to inflation. So that's kind of the choice that we have. We as a legislature can continue to act and keep updating the minimum wage, or we can put in an automatic inflator, as a number of other states have done, that would index it to inflation. And then finally, Section 2 is a pretty simple notice provision that just requires employers to notify new employees that of the minimum wage law and the levels of the minimum wage in their first couple of paychecks so that they have that information in writing. That's the bill, and I think it's pretty easy to understand and explain. So I will ask some of my witnesses to talk about the need for this and then take questions. So I have, and Brad, are you going to testify? Why don't you come on up? We've got Carrie Thomas from the Jobs Now Coalition. Brian Rushi from the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition. We have a server, Renee Croton, and from Plymouth, correct? And Brad Leto from the AFL-CIO.
Okay, thank you and welcome. And Ms. Thomas, if you'd like to go first and just identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Thomas, and I'm with the Jobs Now Coalition. And thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I'll try not to repeat some of the points that Senator Anderson has made. And just to let you know, the Jobs Now Coalition is a statewide coalition of over 100 organizations. We've been around for almost 25 years, and our members include community action programs, employment services providers, food shelves, homeless shelters, social justice organizations, some unions. And as you know, as part of the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938, the original purpose of the minimum wage floor was to put a decent and meaningful floor under wages. It was adopted by Congress to prevent market forces from driving wages below a level deemed fair. So we see the minimum wage as a labor market institution and not a poverty program. And its decline in real terms over the past 30 years has been a major contributor to growing income inequality in the country. According to the Minnesota, the most recent Minnesota job vacancy survey, the median wage of all job openings is stuck at $10 an hour, just above the inflation-adjusted minimum wage of what's now $9.27 an hour that Senator Anderson referenced. Though nearly everyone is anxious to talk about the need to create jobs, there's less talk about finding ways to improve the pay for the jobs that people have. We've been hearing about a pending federal increase to the minimum wage, but that proposal in Congress has essentially become fodder for other policy proposals, including a debate about tax cuts for businesses and attempts to make appropriations bills more palatable to some members of Congress. So we don't know of any movement on that federal bill. And states can simply not wait for Congress to act, just as they haven't been waiting for the past 10 years. So state leadership in Iowa, Kentucky, and New Mexico have made sure that their lowest wage workers will get an increase this year. Another 15 states already had legislated increases that would go into effect in 07, and 10 states have an automatic inflation adjustment. There is a large body of research that has discredited the theory that a higher minimum wage causes job loss, which is often the argument we hear against it. This includes a full refutation of the often cited about 12-year-old research from the Employment Policies Institute. In fact, Princeton University professor Alan Blindner, who's the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve and is the author of one of the most popular college economics textbooks, recently said, "My thinking on this has changed dramatically. The evidence appears to be against the simple-minded theory that a modest increase in the minimum wage causes job loss." And in fact, that's what we've seen in the last 10 years, where we've had a natural experiment that some states have had a higher minimum wage than other states. And on the youth wage, we believe it's time to repeal what we think is an outdated sub-minimum wage for workers under the age of 20. And just so you're aware, of all of the individuals who work in jobs that pay $6.15 or less, only 37% of those are individuals under the age of 20. So actually the majority of workers that pay that work in jobs that pay $6.15 or less are adults. And as you probably have heard a lot this session and in previous sessions, the number one reason that young people work is to save for or to go to college. And steep tuition increases have meant increased borrowing and work for young people. And we don't think there's any reason to that the value of a job should depend on the age of the person who works in it. As Senator Anderson mentioned, I think that Minnesota actually has the most expansive small business exemption of the 19 states with an exemption for small businesses. And we think that this exemption small business wage is sufficient to cover the concerns of small businesses who hire first-time workers. There are only two other states that have a sub-minimum wage for teenagers that is as expansive as Minnesota's, which I will just let you know. The youth wage actually applies to any individual under the age of 20 in any job that they work for the first 90 days, and they can be paid as low as $4.90 an hour. Despite a one-time $1 increase in Minnesota's minimum wage in 2005, the majority of Minnesotans still think that $6.15 is too low. In the fall of 2005, Jobs Now commissioned a series of questions on the minimum wage under the Minnesota State Survey conducted by the University of Minnesota. When asked if the current minimum wage of $6.15 was too high, just about right, or too low, 70% of all Minnesotans say it's too low. Moreover, 80% of Minnesotans believe that the minimum wage should be indexed. Finally, instead of focusing on the over 80,000 workers that make only $6.15 or less, please consider the over 300,000 that work in jobs that pay $7.75 or less, all of them would see some kind of wage increase under this legislation. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Brian Rushi with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, representing the Minnesota Catholic Conference, Minnesota Council of Churches, Jewish Community Relations Council, and the Islamic Center of Minnesota. This is an issue of social justice. We just firmly believe that a person that works full-time year-round shouldn't be poor. And right now, the minimum wage at $6.15, if a person works year-round full-time, that generates an income of about $12,800. The poverty line for a family of three is about $16.6. If you chart the value of the minimum wage against the poverty line for the last 25 years, it's declined rather dramatically. It's also declined rather dramatically in reference to the median wage. So not only is the minimum wage not supplying enough income to meet basic needs, but it's also corrosive in terms of our social structure. This disparity in income that we're seeing is because of a falling wage floor. We need to repair the floor. It's an issue of social justice. This is one of the few policy levers that you have to make sure that there's an income floor that rewards work and addresses the dignity of work and workers. Another facet of social justice is that people have an opportunity to work. And if we thought for a minute that raising the minimum wage to these modest levels did result in serious job loss, we wouldn't support it, because the opportunity to work is equally important. We've seen the last several times that we've raised the minimum wage that there has not been a deleterious employment effect. And the academic research supports that, what Carrie Thomas just mentioned. One of the reasons, and I'll just highlight one of the reasons for that, because it is a little counterintuitive. Usually you think of the cost of an input going up, you're going to want less of that input. But what happens is people aren't inputs. They're human beings, and they respond differently to higher pay. They stay on the job longer, and employers begin to get the benefits of their longevity. There's less churning. And so the employment effect, sometimes even it's been shown in fast food industries, people stay in the jobs for longer periods of time when the pay is higher. So there's less unemployment. So it's an interesting thing that kind of defies the knee-jerk first look. And I wanted to point out that we also are very much, we're not naive about this. If we thought it resulted in a loss of opportunity, we wouldn't support it, but we don't see that. And we think all the evidence points in the direction of you acting to preserve the floor, actually to repair the floor. I'll stop there, Madam Chair, and thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. We have about 10 more minutes, so we'll probably continue this discussion, so just in the next 10 minutes. And thank you for being here today, Ms. Croton. Chair.
And my name is Renee Creighton, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to come and tell you how this impacts me. I'm a single mom of two, and I recently moved to Plymouth about 4 years ago, and there's an increase of cost of living by just moving out to the western suburbs. And I moved out there to have a better school system for my two children. I also find that I need to have – I am a server at the Marquette Hotel, and that's one of three jobs that I have to meet the financial needs of my family. It also allows me the flexibility so that when my son has a 4:45 practice, I can get him to and from practice. And so there's an increase in transportation cost for me as well. And I know I'm one of the lucky ones where I have a union that backs me up. And so when I do have enough hours, I do get health insurance. I do get some pension relief. But it's not always that the hours are there. So I'm trying to work this balance so that I can meet the needs of my children, be flexible to meet to be attending their functions when they have a play performance or a choir concert. I can be there. And it's difficult. You know, as I found when I went for my mortgage, you know, I do not even qualify for the lowest rates because of my income, because they look at what the relationship is between my employer and myself as far as what wage they actually pay me. The rest of it is variable income, and I can't even qualify for the lowest rates ever because I have a variable income. So these are some of the ways that leaving me behind would impact me, and I look forward into
having to apply for college loans, and how could I ever even hope to get a college loan, you know, with on top of the debt that I have, even just for cars and for a mortgage. You know, so those are the ways that this would affect me. And I hope that, you know, and sometimes I feel, you know, I know the industry would like to make me feel like I'm the unicorn, that I'm the last one, that I'm the only single head of household, you know, with two kids to support. But that's not so. There's a herd of us out there that would be left behind if you did not pass this cleanly and did put in a TIP amendment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And Mr. Lito, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senators, and I'll be very brief because you've heard much more eloquent testimony. My name is Brad Leto, Legislative Director. Actually, I should say that former Legislative Director Jennifer Schaubach here is going to be the new Legislative Director, and I'll be Chief of Staff at the Minnesota AFL-CIO. We have had a longstanding tradition of supporting minimum wage increases, and we are happy to support Senator Anderson's bill. Once again, a couple of items I'll just mention. Renee certainly mentioned not leaving tipped employees behind, and for the variety of reasons that, clearly that tips are not, you know, you can say that the government counts that as income. Unfortunately, mortgage companies, a lot of other folks do not count that as income. And as you've heard here, the training wage, and people say, why are you getting rid of the training wage? 18 and 19-year-old people making $4.90 an hour. Just think about that for a second. Does that make a lot of sense to make $4.90 an hour to have a training wage? People under 20 years of age. Indexing to inflation, we think that is probably the once we get the wage up to where it makes sense, and it makes sense to index it and keep it going. Inflation this year is probably about 1.6% or 2%. I mean, you're not talking about a lot of money here, but it at least keeps us in some semblance of increase. And finally, I would just mention the notification section, which is actually, I believe, included in our urging. We've heard a lot of discussion, especially when we have a small business, large business, minimum wage, when we've had the training wage. People will call, I know they've called the legislature a number of times, but they've actually called our office as well to find out, you know, what is the minimum wage? What should I be making? And there's a lot of times, and we don't think it's a great onus, and in fact, you heard about the notice requirements in previous legislation today. This is asking for a small slip of paper in the first two paychecks for new employees to find out what they should be making on the minimum wage and where they can call if they have questions. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions at this point? I think we're going to recess at this point until 6 p.m. instead of start the other testimony. And we will start promptly at 6 p.m., and so we'd like everybody back at that time. Yes, Senator Michelle.
A question then for the remainder of the agenda that starts at 6.
Mm-hmm.
What do we plan to take and in what order?
I believe we're going to try to get through all the bills today, is my understanding.
Will you be in this room?
And it will be in this room. With that, we will recess until 6. You know, any other questions?
Yeah.
All right.
Linda.
Oh, thank you.
No, I don't think so.
Does minimum wage apply to our salary?
I know. I said at least 20 minutes.
Yeah.